welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. Kay Murray and Cheka Hislop here in the studio. A little later on, we're going to be hearing from Mark Clattenburg as he discusses a controversial decision in the England-Germany final in the Women's Euros. But we will start by continuing the conversation about Cristiano Ronaldo leaving the friendly game with Rayo Vallecano early. The papers have had a field day. See you later. It's all gone wrong. And more of the normal headlines, like Ronaldo told he has to stay. Anyway, after the game, Erik ten Hag was asked what he thought about players leaving before the match had finished. And he said, this is unacceptable. I tell them this, that's unacceptable. We're a team, we are a squad. You have to stay until the end. Now, at first it was unclear whether the new coach had given permission for the players to leave. This would say absolutely not, as we welcome in Julien Laurent and Frank Leboeuf. The narrative has changed dramatically, Jules.
I'm not sure if change is the right word, Kay, because there was no narrative before. We were just waiting to see what was going to happen and what would Erik ten Hag or the club say first, because the club was asked straight after the game on Sunday, hang on a minute, was he allowed, was he given permission to leave, him and Diogo Dalot, for example, as well, before the end of the game, or was that not agreed by the club and by the manager? The club didn't say anything. There was no press conference after the game, which was planned before, with Erik ten Hag. He was only interviewed by MUTV, the club in-house television, who obviously didn't ask the question about if Cristiano was allowed to leave the stadium before the end of the game. So we had to wait a little bit more, and finally those quotes came from Holland today. And it was damning. It was damning for Cristiano, which we discussed it with Gab on the show on Monday, and we said it was unacceptable. It was unacceptable already. Now I'm really hoping that Cristiano and Dalot, to be fair, will be fined, because this is again, you go against the rules set by the club and set by your manager, you deserve to be fined. And you cannot allow things like that to happen, especially considering the situation with Cristiano, the fact that he wants to leave, the fact that the club said they want him to stay, but we're not really sure, and what do you want to do with him? It doesn't really fit in what Ten Hag wants to do anyway. So this is really, really something that they could have done without.
So how do you solve a problem like Ronaldo?
But that's the challenge for Ten Hag here. Just kind of given what he means to the club. The truth is, Erik ten Hag as manager has to be the one who's in complete control of everything about this club, including the narrative. Immediately after the game against Rayo Vallecano, the club tried to downplay Ronaldo's exit, which I couldn't understand. Even if permission was given, it didn't make sense to me, given all the issues that Manchester United already have, this does not help. So now Ten Hag has made his own position be known clear. And I think he's absolutely right in saying what he did. And he has to establish himself as the leader of this dressing room. The challenge becomes a balancing act between his authority and manager as manager and the influence that Ronaldo continues to have on that football club because of his standing and popularity with the fans, which in my mind is secondary to the manager and his authority in thinking long-term for this football club. So Jules is right. If it means a fine, then so be it. What that looks like, who knows? But clearly there's a huge disconnect between Ten Hag, the club, Ronaldo. I don't think Ronaldo will be a Manchester United player come September. Finding that exit is difficult, but I think it's finding it is one that is in everyone's best interest.
Finding the exit from the game wasn't too difficult.
What do you think, though,
Frank, with Erik ten Hag saying this one? Important that he stamps his authority at this stage?
Yes, but were we really waiting for Ten Hag to make that statement to know that it was unacceptable? I think even Ronaldo and Dalot know that it's unacceptable. So now we have of course Ten Hag had to say that. Of course they have to be fined, and you have to be only a Ronaldo fan or Ronaldo Dalot to find that acceptable. So now, having said that, why they did that? Because they think they are allowed to. So, because they don't want to stay at the club. because they don't care. They don't care about their teammates, they don't care about their fans, they don't care about even the club. They don't care about what people are going to say, because they know that everybody is going to mention that. So it's another statement from Ronaldo and Dalot, because we have to put Dalot in it. We don't want to stay about Manchester. We don't want to stay at Manchester United because we don't care about Manchester United anymore. We want to leave the club. That's, for me, the statement. So Ten Hag has to, of course, say something, but I'm more concerned about what really meant what Dalot and Ronaldo did instead of what Ten Hag can say about it.
Do you think that's fair, what Frank's saying there, Shaka, that Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't care about Manchester United?
He cares more about his exit than the club right now. And yes, Frank is absolutely right in saying what he did. He cares about creating such an atmosphere that the club are forced to bend in some way to get Ronaldo that move, whatever that may look like. But Frank is right. If you are there, right, you are determined to get Manchester United back on track, get them to where they believe they should be. Let's put this Ronaldo's Champions League legacy to aside for a moment. This is about the football club. You don't walk out. You absolutely do not. You stay there till the end. And you, whatever the team has planned after, you're there until you're excused from it. In walking out, you are trying to create an atmosphere, and we've all either seen it or done it, where you're trying to craft a move and you're just being a little problematic to force the club's hand. And that's exactly what he's doing. And to be honest, Ronaldo, as huge a fine as it may be, 2 weeks' wages or whatever is the maximum, that's not going to bother Cristiano Ronaldo. So he knows that he has got that wiggle room to play with in terms of upsetting the club.
Because we keep talking, Jules, about where he is going to go next, and nobody seems to be able to answer this. It doesn't even seem as though his own team and the people behind him are able to answer this right now. What does it appear is still on the table for Cristiano Ronaldo? Which potential clubs could he go to?
It's a really good question. I think maybe towards the end of the transfer window, at the end of August, when we will know a bit more if really the only option is for him to leave the club. And I don't think if that's the case, if Manchester United say, you know what, actually it's better for everybody if you leave now, and they don't ask for any transfer fee, and maybe I think Cristiano and Jorge Mendes are intelligent enough to say to any clubs that could be or might be interested, listen, we're going to take a pay cut. We're not going to be the same level of wages that United have been paying him last season, for example. Then maybe there's a possibility that you find a club. We said it before. It's crazy that one of the greatest players of all time, for some, the greatest player of all time, is being like offered pretty much everywhere and anywhere, and clubs say no. PSG is a no. Chelsea is a no. Bayern Munich is a no. Napoli is a no. Atletico Madrid is a no. For, you know, we're not talking about me. We're talking about Cristiano Ronaldo here. It's normal for people to say no to me. It's not normal to say no to the, one of the greatest players of all time. And yet, this is the situation that he finds himself, which personally, I find shameful. If I was him, I would not want to be offered there and there and there and then getting a no every time, getting rejected and denied every time. I don't think this is good for him, for his image, for his legacy, for everything. And this is a position that surely they're not enjoying to be in. Him, Jorge Mendes, and all the entourage. So I don't know what the solution will be. I don't know where he will be on September the 1st. He could well still be at Manchester United. And when we see what's been happening in the last 6 weeks, I think it would be disastrous if he was still at the club come September, because he doesn't want to be there. Clearly, the boys are right. He would not leave early on Sunday when this is his... Let's not forget, he didn't go on tour for family reasons, which we have to believe. We have to believe him when he says he's got family issues. So, okay, that's one thing. Then you come back. He's got this message on Instagram saying the king plays on Sunday. Okay, no problem. He plays 45 minutes and then he leaves. Come on, this is not good enough.
All right, well, let's move on to talk about some more transfer talk. And at the time of taping, I must stress that, but it does appear that Chelsea are closing in on a deal for Mark Cucurella from Brighton and have offered more than £50 million for the left back, even though Brighton have put out a tweet saying that reports are inaccurate from numerous media outlets and there has been no agreement reached by any club. What are you hearing here, Jules?
The negotiations and the discussions are still going on between Chelsea and Brighton. I believe the structure of the deal is, and that transfer fee is the problem. If you're Brighton, you want as much of that amount straight away instead of having it spread out on the length of the contract of Cucurella, which would be 5 years potentially. So let's say 10 million every summer instead of getting a bigger chunk now, which is often something that happens between clubs, especially between top clubs and smaller clubs, if you want. No offence to Brighton. So I believe it's only a question of structuring the deal more than the deal not to happen. But if you're Brighton and nothing has been agreed, this is your right to put out, hang on a minute, okay, it might happen and it will probably happen and the player wants it to happen, he really wants to go and he believes that we're very close to an agreement. But if there's no agreement yet, I think Brighton are within their rights to put something out, a statement or a tweet or a post, a message, something saying, listen, there's no agreement yet. This, again, has happened many times before. It's a bit of a poker game between clubs. And again, especially between big clubs and smaller clubs. But I don't think really that transfer is in doubt. I think it will happen because the money that Chelsea are ready to pay is huge for someone like Cucurella. For Cucurella, this is a great move, of course. And then Brighton can reinvest that money cleverly like they always do. So I think it's a question of when the deal happens more than will it happen. But right now, the structure is not agreed yet.
Frank, what do you think of this whole decision?
Well, you know, football has changed dramatically, but I'm still not ready to hear though the amounts of millions of transfer that we see for a player who played for Getafe and Brighton. 50 million. 15 million per year fee is what I saw written on the screen. I mean, that's a good player. It's a very good player. But 50 million for me were for stars, where people will have enough experience to change something. Cucurella has shown some qualities for sure, but I don't know. Really, with all due respect, 50 million. I think Chelsea are too rich, like so many other clubs.
What was it? 45
in the world
million for Chilwell.
Who have too much money.
Yeah, it's the price of football.
Well, okay. Yeah. Yeah, but that's the price. That's the price. You are telling me that's the price. Well, I remember.
No, that's not to say the price for him. It's the same position, and it's 100 million in the same position if that goes through, right?
Yeah, but, well, you know, again, allow me to think that it's overall too much money for those players. And the world of football is getting crazy. That's what I think. You know, I remember Roberto Di Matteo signing for Chelsea for 5 million. And he was at Roma. Yes, it was 25 years ago. I don't even talk about my transfer fee because it was even lesser. But really, I'm stunned. I don't care if Paris Saint-Germain pays Neymar of 222 million because he's a big star. And I hear that. But we are talking about, and again, with all due respect, about Cucurella playing for Brighton, coming from Getafe. And the club asked for 50 million. Well, you know, hopefully he's going to be good enough to play some games for Chelsea and be strong enough to make Chelsea win a trophy in the Premier League and in the Champions League. Excuse me,
it wouldn't have happened in my day. Those figures weren't getting talked about in my day. Frank, we put together a potential 11 for Chelsea next season, and we wanted to get your thoughts on it. Not the price, but your thoughts on the players that you're seeing here in this 11.
I love that. I love that team. I think James and Chilwell have been missed last season because of their injuries. Let's say with Cucurella alongside Silva and Koulibaly. But yeah, I think it's a very balance first 11, and you have the names of the players underneath, where of course can bring a lot. And I think it's a decent team, a very decent team. We can do and create trouble. I don't think they can win the Premier League and they can beat Manchester City or Liverpool, but they can aim the same spot that they reached last season, the third.
All right, Frank, well, talking about Premier League, we wanted to bring up your predictions, especially while you're in this wonderful mood that you are. Champion Manchester City, runner-up Liverpool, third Chelsea.
No real surprises.
Fourth Spurs, Manchester United in sixth, top scorer Son Heung-min. Player of the year, I don't answer to that. And then your relegation picks at the bottom. So, Frank, I don't answer to that. I'm going to pick you up on that one first.
Yeah, well, of course, because I hate that, because you cannot compare a goalkeeper with a centre-back and a striker. And I will keep on answering that, you know, until my last breath. Those guys who made those things happening, existing, are stupid people and insulting my football, the football that I love, which is a collective football. You can ask me the best 11, and I would be happy to serve you, but the best player of the year doesn't mean anything. Like the Ballon d'Or doesn't mean anything. Voilà.
Voila. All right, let's get Jules' picks as well. A little similar in some parts to Frank's picks in that it's City and Liverpool.
Oh, that's easy enough.
First and second there. He's got Spurs in third, Arsenal fourth, and he says that Manchester United and Chelsea will miss out on the top four.
Six is nothing similar at all between their six.
I just bet
could be any more in the front.
The fact, I tell you what is similar. They both left United out of the top four.
Oh, goodness, you grabbed their straws here, Key.
But he has actually picked Kevin De Bruyne as his player of the year. He's not so upset about that. And top scorer Mo Salah. Let's focus on Chelsea in sixth, though, can we, Jules? Especially while we've got Frank here.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think this summer is a shambles. And I think Thomas Tuchel is worried. And he's right to be worried. Again, this is the prediction of today. There's still 3 weeks to go between now and the end of the transfer window. And in 3 weeks, a lot of things can change. And they can sign Cucurella that we just mentioned, and then De Jong, and then a striker, and then another. So the squad can become better with more depth. And then that can reassure everyone. But right now, I'm worried for Chelsea. I don't know what kind of Chelsea I will see. If Tuchel is worried himself, I think we should all be worried, really. Koulibaly is a great signing and so is Sterling, but overall, this is a team that has lost a lot of leadership as well. This is a team that, even last season, had issues. I don't think those issues have been resolved yet. So I'm very sceptical about this season. Again, between now and the end of the transfer window, a lot of things can happen. And I hope for Chelsea that they strengthen the squad with the right players in the right positions. And then things can change. I just think that between United, Arsenal and Chelsea, they won't be much. I think they will be quite close for that fourth place. I think Spurs will be better, and then obviously Liverpool and City too. So between them three, they will fight for this fourth place. I think Arsenal have the potential to have a really good season with Ten Hag and United. Again, I'm not sure what kind of United we will see, and I still think that they're three or four players short of what they should be, really, to compete with everybody else. So that's the reason why I went fourth, fifth and sixth for Arsenal, Chelsea and United, or United and Chelsea.
Frank, you politely raised your hand there because you don't seem to be worried about Chelsea at all. You've got them finishing third.
Well, the thing is, I'm very surprised, you know, because he just said that Manchester United can be going through a disaster because Ronaldo might stay or not, and that because it's already a big mess inside the dressing room. But he still thinks that Chelsea is going to go worse. Nothing happened last season badly at Chelsea. You know, they finished third. I don't know how come, you know, Manchester United can be in his head better than Chelsea with all the mess that we saw last season and with the precedent that they had. So, you know, I made, you know, the statement that Jules doesn't like Chelsea. That's what it is.
Jules is the Chelsea hater. Jules is a Chelsea hater.
Not that Frank loves Chelsea, but Jules hates Chelsea.
Jules hates Chelsea as much as Frank hates Real Madrid.
Totally partial when it comes to Chelsea.
The Premier League's new season kicks off at Selhurst Park on Friday as Crystal Palace take on Arsenal. Arsenal are solid favourites for an away win, but if you cast your mind back to last season, you'll remember Arsenal were away to open the Premier League against Brentford, and they lost that game. So those are good odds for a Crystal Palace win.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. As is customary in the Bundesliga, the title winners from the previous season, Bayern Munich, start the campaign. They will be taking on Eintracht Frankfurt on Friday, 2:30 Eastern. Your coverage begins full build-up with our team on site in Frankfurt as well. Make sure not to miss that and every game on ESPN Plus this season. But dominating German sports papers right now is talk of foul play in the Women's Euro final. This is a title dream shattered after a scandalous scene. Clear handball penalty refused. Wembley fraud again. It all comes down to the 25th minute of the match when there was a potential handball, not given, on Leah Williamson, the English captain. Luckily, we have a referee, Mark Klassenberg, joining us. Frank and Jules are still with us. So, Mark, tell us more about this decision. And it was looked at. Why wasn't it given?
I think it's going to be very difficult for an Englishman to explain this one, because when the ball bops around, when the ball bops around in the penalty area, the actual ball strikes the arm of the defender. And what we look at as referees is, you know, we worry about distance. And sometimes in cases when the distance is short, we worry about where the hand is. And when the hand is above the shoulder, which this is, therefore, it doesn't matter how short the distance is, it's always going to be given as a penalty kick when the arm is this high up and above the shoulder, because we as referees deem that the arm should not be in this position anywhere above the shoulder unless they're jumping for the ball, which can make the arm be above the shoulder. In this case, the arm is above the shoulder and should be given as a penalty. There is an argument, should it be a red card? I don't believe it should be, because we can't be sure as referees that this ball is going to go inside the goal, because there's another defender covering. So probably a yellow card should have been shown if the penalty was given.
So they have a right to feel aggrieved, the Germans then, Mark?
Probably after 1966, they're going to complain ever since. Always at Wembley, something always happens, of course. And they'll always argue. But this is, you know, we talk about handball. We're going to talk about handball for the rest, you know, this season, next season and the season after. And it's what the referees deem is deliberate playing. For me, this was probably one of the easier ones. Why did the VAR not interfere? Probably because UEFA have such a high tolerance level compared to the MLS, compared to the Premier League, where they don't interfere as much. They allow the referee to give the on-field decision.
How much coverage is this getting back in England, Jules?
Zero, nothing, not at all. All the coverage is about the Lionesses celebrating, the parade, the trophy, Trafalgar Square, everything you want. They could not care less about if it was a handball or not, if the ball rolled onto the chest of Williamson before hitting the arm or not. There was no German players even appealing on the moment itself. So I think he went so quick. I think it's one of those where if the referee gives it, then VAR goes along with it. And same, the referee doesn't give it, didn't see it. And I think especially, like as Mark just said, with the attitude towards VAR from UEFA and the instructions, they were never going to overturn it and you know, send the referee to see it, for example, at the screen or anything like that. So, but nothing in England. It's just the noise coming from Germany. They could not even care, to be fair.
What do you think of this moment, Shaka?
Let me say that's a handball and should have been given. I do sympathise with the referee, which I don't often do. Not a single player appeals. In that goal-mouth melee, not a single German player appeals. So you understand the referee not seeing it herself. Once it goes to video, though, and VAR reviews, I think it should be given. And here's the challenge around this and writing a law that... I often say you cannot write a law that covers every single situation in the game. And Mark talks about the arm being up above the shoulder, and he's absolutely right, and that's how the law is written. If I'm a goalkeeper and the ball is that close to me, and I'm going to make a save with my arms, I'm not putting them above my head. So that's the kind of catch-22 in this. If I'm allowed to use my arms isn't above my head. But you go you find your arm in that unnatural position, and I know that isn't a part of the law either, and it hits. You understand where the uncertainty comes from. But I say all that to say, for me, this is a handball. And once VAR, according to the angles that they're given, sees this, I don't understand how it isn't. But it also shows how uncertain the law is and just the interpretation of it.
Handball for you, Frank?
Yeah, for sure. And I'm pretty sure that the captain of England didn't do it on purpose. It's a reflex. I've been a defender, and sometimes you want to move. You try to make your body bigger, and you don't know how it comes, but your hands comes up. It's kind of a reflex. You don't want to touch the ball with the hand because you know you're going to be punished, but it goes like that with your movement of your body. Now it's funny to see how easily people can forget stuff, you know, and I remember France in 2018 when we won the World Cup, where Griezmann had a free kick and it wasn't a free kick, and that everybody saw that, but nobody talked about it in France. And I think the second it was a penalty, and the defender was completely blinded by the French player, didn't see it, so it wasn't for me a penalty, but nobody talked about it in France. So English people are going to be deaf or blind, but it's only fair, you know, they won and they don't want to talk about it because they don't care. It's sad for football because. And it's sad for the German players, the ladies, because I think, you know, I played a World Cup. I would have lost a final of a World Cup because of a referee bad decision. I think I would be looking for the referee for the rest of my life, you know, to tell him my truth, you know, and what will I really think about him, and maybe more. So it's, you don't reach a Euro final every four years. It's one maybe in your lifetime, and somebody, when he had the tools to sort the problem out, didn't do the right thing. That's very sad for the German players.
Yeah, and in fairness, Vos Tecklenburg, the German manager, has said she's upset about the decision, but she does feel that England would have still won the game overall and has given them credit for that one. So I thought I should mention that. She's been very classy about it. Let's look at the Community Shield then. Man City's goal is the next one we want to bring up for you, Mark. Julian Alvarez. There are a few layers to this one because it's all going to come down to if Adrian had control of the ball when Phil Foden plays it. What more can you tell us about this type of decision?
This is a really, really difficult decision because it's very complex. What you do see, if you really look at the top of the screen, the assistant referee flagged because he believes there's an offside. So first of all, the VAR's checking the offside, and then he's then looking at, has Adriano got control of the ball? I don't believe he has. When I watched it live, I thought he spilled the ball. I don't think he ever gets control of it. And even the attacker doesn't, for example, kick the ball out of his hands. He doesn't touch the ball. Yes, he comes over the top. Maybe he puts him off, which he's allowed to do because he's in an onside position. I believe Adriano spills the ball and therefore becomes alive, and therefore they're entitled to play the ball a second time, and therefore the goal's clean for me.
What do you make of it all, Shaka, as a goalkeeper?
I agree with Mark again. I thought this was a goal, and this is coming from a member, fully paid up member of the Goalkeepers Union. But as we saw it first time, watching the game, my initial reaction was to question whether that was a foul by Foden on Adriano. And then as I saw the replays, I thought, no, I didn't think he had full control of the ball. I thought he spilled it. Alvarez comes in and picks up the pieces. So the goal for me, I think, stood, and rightly so.
We wanted to bring up a comparison, actually, with this one, and you'll probably remember it from the Premier League when Aston Villa took on Leicester. It was Kasper Schmeichel. This is the moment, fouled by Aston Villa's Jacob Ramsey. Similar situation here, Mark.
No, I don't think it's similar. There is some sort of similarities, but it's not fully the same. Where we talked about Adriana not getting control over the ball and spills it, what Kasper Schmeichel does at this moment, he got his hand on the ball and wants to put the hand on the ball. The way the law is written, he has control over the ball, and then it's kicked out of his hand. With the Adriano one, we believe that he spilled the ball, which means that the attackers are now allowed to take the second phase, which is what happened, and therefore ended as a goal. With Kasper Schmeichel, I believe he has control over the ball once he puts his hand on the ball. A bit like we have a sport in England called rugby. When you put the ball down, or rugby union, rugby league, you put the hand on the ball over the try line, it's a goal, it's a try. It's the same as a goalkeeper. Once they put the hand on the ball, it's therefore their possession, and you can't kick the ball out of the hand.
So then it's a foul and the goal has to be disallowed. What do you make of it, Frank?
Well, I have to listen to Mark, and if Mark said that Schmeichel is in control of the ball, I want to believe him, even if I think he wasn't, and because even the ball was kicked and not his gloves, not his hands. So I understand that the law is written like that. I think it's unfair because definitely Schmeichel is not, for me, in control of the ball, even if I really, and Mark said it clearly, that putting his hand on the ball makes him be in control of it. I don't agree with that, but if the law say that, it's only fair to be disallowed. So on Adrian and the first goal, yesterday the Community Shield, for me it's a clear goal, and for sure Adrian wasn't in control of the ball.
Do you think it's a similar situation, Shaka?
Yes, and I'm a little bit reluctant in how I answer this, because clearly my membership to the Goalkeepers Union is already up for review. I think
it's in jeopardy.
The point that Mark is making and how it's interpreted, Schmeichel's hand is on top of the ball, whereas Adrian's out to the side. And I think that's, to the layman's eye, the difference comes. But that being said, I'm with Frank. I don't think Kasper Schmeichel has full control of the ball at all. I think I said at the time as well that I thought the goal should have stood. And again, I see the similarities, but I also see the differences. But I still don't think that Kasper Schmeichel has full control, despite his hand being in a better position than Adrian's was.
Who's right, Joel? Shaka and Frank, or Mark, the referee?
Choose carefully, Jules. The referee's always right. So Mark has to be right on this one. I get all the side of the arguments. I think in the Community Shield, it's a big fumble by Adrian. I think he's appealing for a foul because he knows he made a big mistake, and that he was not very good in that game overall anyway. For Schmeichel, I think it's a bit harsh. If you're Ramsey, Aston Villa, Steven Gerrard, to see that goal being disallowed, again, the law is the law, and we have to go along with it, of course. But maybe there's something, again, a bit like the handball, where
there could be a clearer rule or a clearer law, maybe for more consistency, I guess, in a way. I don't know, but certainly it was a bit harsh, it felt, on Aston Villa and Ramsey.
Let's get to another decision then from the Community Shield. While we do have you here with us, Mark Klassenberg, Ruben Diaz's handball. Tell us more about this decision here, because Craig Pawson checked the pitch side monitor and pointed to the spot.
This is one where I think if we watched this many times in the Premier League over the last years, this would never be given. The VAR, because the referee didn't give it on the field, the VAR would never interfere in this. And this is going to be a surprising change if the Premier League now decide that this is going to be the level of handball we're going to give, because we've seen many, many cases where the arm's more unnatural, it's more wider, and the penalty wasn't given. But what's interesting is if we remember the first leg of the Champions League, Manchester City, Real Madrid, Manchester City were again punished for this type of offence, and Guardiola accepted the handball. So in Europe and in UEFA competitions, this will always be given. However, the Premier League never, ever give this. And if this is a change of direction, this must be coming from Mike Riley, that they're now going to punish this as handball. But when I saw it in the Community Shield, I was quite surprised, because if we look at the past years, like I said before, it was never given.
Frank Donnan-Nadum all said this was never a handball. No. Seeing it again, Frank, are you still feeling that way?
Well, that one, no, that's a handball. But I have a question for Mark. I want to know, because we all see from behind the net, well, on the side, that the ball is not going into the net. So it doesn't interfere with a ball going to make a goal, in fact. So so is it something you can take in consideration or not? Because, well, we don't see from that one, but the next one, you're going to see that the ball is going out. So, can it be taken in consideration that the ball is not going in the net?
No, because, Frank, it's very similar. For example, if you get fouled, as you take a shot and it's getting, the ball goes out for a goal kick, and just before the ball goes out the field of play, the player's, you know, brought down in the penalty area, you've still got to punish the offence if the ball's still in play. If you deem this as a handball, which I do, because I believe the arm is outstretched and the arm, he's making himself bigger, which is what we tried to take into consideration. It doesn't matter if the ball is not going to a teammate, the ball is not going inside the goal. The point of the fact of the law is the ball still in the field of play? Yes, it is. Did the ball strike the arm? Yes, it did. Did the referee deem it because the arm is outside of the body in an unnatural position? He did. I don't believe this is consistent to what the Premier League referees have been given over the years. However, UEFA used to punish this week in, week out, like we saw in the first leg of the Champions League semi-final.
And Mark, we want to go through some of the new points of emphasis in the Premier League, just talking about some of the new rules that have been put into play for the new season, including more rest for teams and a packed schedule, teams being able to use up to 5 subs, increased focus on holding within the penalty area. There are a few here. Which one stands out to you? Which one would you like to focus in on?
It's interesting because we talk about the time wasting, the multi-ball system. I'm not clear and I'm not comfortable with the multi-ball system in the Premier League. If we use big stadiums like Frank and used to play in, and Shaka, for example, when you used to have the athletic stadiums where they used to have the athletic tracks, okay, I understand multi-ball systems. However, the Premier League stadiums are very tight, very compact. The ball is thrown automatically back in from the crowd. I don't believe multi-ball systems work. And I used to recall many, many times coaches used to use this as a tactic for even more time wasting. They used to tell the ball boys if you were winning to slow the game down, if they were losing to make sure that the ball comes back quick for the home team. So for me, I don't believe the multi-ball system works. But we have a big problem. They're now, I think it was working out, an average 55 minutes per game. This cannot be accepted for the Premier League, where they want to increase the time. They want to increase, you know, more playing time. They want to get close to 65 minutes. How do they do that? Is the multi-ball system the way forward? I don't believe it is. I think the referees have a duty, and also the clubs have a duty, and the players have a duty. I think if we watch, for example, Southampton last year, Southampton, for example, used to, around 75 minutes, create an injury so the players could take in fluids, they could take in gels, all the energy drinks, which helped them perform for the last 15 minutes. So that was a tactic. These are the things that the referees have to stop, not the multi-ball system, which I believe has always been flawed.
But in a nutshell, what actually is the multi-ball system? How would you explain it to somebody who doesn't understand that?
It's where, for example, I think if we use, I think there's 10 people around the playing surface, which brings the ball back quicker. So if the ball goes into the crowd, the ball boy or the ball girl will throw the ball to the nearest player, and then he's entitled to bring the ball into play as quick as possible. We've seen this with Jose Mourinho, where he used to praise his ball girls or ball boys for bringing the ball in fast, which created a goal. And I remember he praised, I think it was at Tottenham, where they got a goal created by the ball girl, I think the ball boy at the time, making the ball faster so that the home team or the team couldn't get back into position. It's used for certain advantages. And I think when we want to bring in more playing time, I don't believe that the multi-ball system is the way forward.
I want to pick you up on the increased focus on holding within the penalty area. Like, how do you clamp down on this?
I'm not sure that's a problem. I used to watch holding. Before VAR, holding was a big problem. I think referees were scared to give penalties. This was for sure. I think it was the easier decision to give a defensive free kick, especially on attacking free kicks and corners. But I believe VAR stopped this now because they're so scared now, the defenders, to create a hold, knowing that it could be punished by VAR. So I don't think that was a problem, and I don't think that should have been an issue going forward for anybody really to cause an alarm, because the last 1 or 2 years, I don't see that as a bad trend.
Do you agree with Mark here, Jules? Is there anything that stood out to you with the new points of emphasis for Premier League rules?
Yeah, no, I agree with him. I think the multi-ball, it was the case before the pandemic, then he stopped for, I don't know, like the reasons the pandemic made that we just, at some point we didn't have any ball boys anymore, to be fair. And then just the one ball. I'm not convinced either that it will speed up the game, and that instead of just playing, having a 55 or 50 minute playing time during 90 minutes, we will have 60 or 65. I don't know. I don't mind it, to be fair, but I don't think it's the answer either and the solution. For holding in the box, I agree with Mark again. I think it's less common than he used to for a long time. I remember in France, and Frank will remember, one season the referees decided that they should literally give a penalty pretty much every time they was holding. I remember Mario Yepes at PSG at the time against Sochaux, away, a game I was reporting on, giving two penalties against himself for holding in the box. But after that, there was so much outrage because it was PSG as well that they stopped it and never did it again in the season. So if you look at holding in the box much more, then you'd have to give a penalty a lot more as well, which I don't think anyone is ready for. So it'd be interesting to see who does what and how much you take that in consideration in your refereeing. But in the end, I'm not sure it's going to change much.
Well, Mark, we won't hold you for much longer. Thanks so much for being with us and clearing up a few points for us there. We'll no doubt speak to you again soon. You can keep up to date with everything and all the latest headlines on ESPN FC by tuning in daily. Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at lectricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's lectricebikes.com.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
A Girona are back in the top flight of La Liga after winning promotion in the playoffs over Tenerife last season. Their first game comes away at Valencia, La Liga's opening weekend just around the corner. All games available on ESPN Plus. Very much looking forward to it. And can you believe it is 5 years since Neymar left La Liga for PSG, becoming the most expensive player in football history when he joined the Parisians from Barcelona for €222 million. Well, remember, they activated his transfer clause. Since then, PSG still haven't won the Champions League. It does seem as though that is the main focus every season with this club. And in fact, Mauricio Pochettino has been talking about his time at PSG and said the obsession is the Champions League and not winning it is synonymous with failure. Well, good job that we've got Jules and Frank here for this topic. Once again, it does seem, Jules, it is Champions League or bust when it comes to PSG.
No, what's a failure is to lose the way Pochettino's team has lost at Real Madrid against at the Bernabeu against Real Madrid. That's a failure. A failure is not to not win the Champions League. The failure is to be knocked out the way they did in the last 16 second leg. That's a failure, and that failure is on him. And I find it really, really sad in a way for him to open his mouth now and said, oh, you know, they didn't give me time because I didn't win the Champions League, then I was a failure. No, you were a failure because you lost that game and you didn't even react when your team was starting to sink. That's the problem here. You know, other managers have reached finals, semi-finals, including him for the semi-final. But the failure was that defeat in Madrid. It was nothing else. And yes, he's judged mostly on that, and maybe on that point, he has a point himself, but it's maybe too narrow thinking to just judge him, or not judge him, but mostly judging him on that defeat. But that defeat is the biggest game of their season. And on that defeat, on that game, he was absent. He didn't deliver at all. So I find it, I find it a bit sad for him to say those kind of things, because yes, he's very important and he's their dream, like he's the dream for every single big clubs in Europe to win that, and especially for them because they've never won it. But it's a failure if you lose in the way they did, in a humiliating way like that. Not if you lose in a final or in a semi-final, like he did the previous season against Man City, for example.
Frank?
Yeah, I could totally agree with Jules in the matter of Pochettino complaining about something that he wasn't good enough to sort out. But it's time for the PSG to really understand that it doesn't matter the coach you're going to get. You know, every season you almost have the same turn of event in the Champions League. So it's not really to win the Champions League, it's to avoid losing the way they now used to lose in and being eliminated from the Champions League. We saw so many times all through the years that we follow Paris Saint-Germain and we want to see them winning the Champions League, so many games that they lost because of not being there, not being tuned in, thinking that they're better than the others. So it's of course due to the coaches, but we have to think that it's due to the players. And we have to name names because, yeah.
No, sorry, continue, Frank. You have to name names.
No, it's just the fact that, because and I won't be the only one to name names, because you just named Neymar and the fact that he's been for 5 years at Paris Saint-Germain, but what they achieved since he signed is mostly more issues than silverware. Yeah, domestic silverware, but again, we don't care because with the players that they have, the amount of money that they spend for those players, of course everybody expects them to win the Champions League at some point. You could have said the same for Manchester City, but Manchester City is in the Premier League and fights against Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester United, Arsenal. They don't fight against Lorient, I don't know, and with all due respect, Strasbourg and some other little clubs. So it's normal for Paris Saint-Germain to win the domestic competitions, but we want to see them fighting in the final of the Champions League every year because of the player that they have. And it's all not only because of the coaches, again, it's mainly now, and I'm sure about that, mainly because of some players.
It does seem strange, though, Jules. As Frank's just saying, you can talk about Ligue 1, but PSG is so often and so universally judged by how they do in the Champions League each season. Is that a weird way to judge a side?
It is a bit, and there's other ways to do it, but Frank is right, and we all know it, that the league should be won every season by PSG, and when they don't win it, which happens sometimes, not often, but it happens sometimes with Montpellier and then with Lille and obviously with Monaco, then that's an even bigger failure. But then, of course, the Champions League, because this is the competition where is at their level, really, or they're even not good enough, really, to go and win it compared to Ligue 1, for example, or the French Cup or the French League Cup before. So, in a way, you understand why this is the level where you have to judge them. You have to judge them against teams of their level, which there's none in Ligue 1, but the teams at their level are there in the Champions League. So you judge them in a game against Real Madrid or Barcelona or City or Chelsea or Liverpool, etc., etc., etc. And whether they do well, they reach the final. This is an amazing season, and they were very close to potentially beating Bayern Munich and winning that final in 2020. It was not so good in 2022. It was still quite good in 2021 when you reach the semi-final and you're very much in the game after the first leg, or at least during the first leg, and then the second leg away at City is more difficult. But so sometimes, even when you don't win it, it can be a positive season and you can have a positive European campaign. The problem, as we've been saying, is those big games that they lose, those big failures, the remontadas, etc., which happen every 3 years, the last nine years. But I guess there's another season and another campaign of Champions League every year, which brings new hope. Now there's a new manager. Maybe he will find the right formula. It's the dream, I think, and the hope for all the fans and all the people at the club.
Well, let me ask you, Jules. First of all, do you think that they're in a better position to win it this year? And what does their best 11 look like to you?
I think it's a better squad and a more balanced squad than I think they maybe ever had, and certainly better than last season, in the sense that the recruitment that they've done is quite clever, I think. They're getting rid of players as well who were not going to play, the likes of Paredes and Gay and Wijnaldum, those kind of guys that they didn't want there anymore. And they bring people like Renato Sanchez and Vitinha, who bring something a little bit different, who are younger, with more energy, that can bring more intensity, that can play different positions. I think this is better. We saw Messi already much sharper than he ever was last season. Neymar, I think, has a point to prove, and he knows it. And obviously, you've got Kylian Mbappe, who decided to stay, and who you could expect be in the form of his life this season coming with the World Cup and etc. So I think they're in a better place in terms of the squad. The manager, there's still a question mark, because this is the highest level that he's ever been at, and this is all new for him. So he needs a bit of time, but I'm still a bit skeptical about what he can bring to that team. But I guess we'll have to see. And then, I don't know, every year at this time you ask me the question, and every time I dream and I say, yes, we're going to win the Champions League, and we never do. So I'm going to say it again. Yes, they can win it, of course. They will need to click. They will need a lot of things to happen their way, to go their way, for them to go and win it. But with players like that, if Sergio Ramos stays fit, and Messi, and Neymar, and Mbappe, of course it's possible. It's always possible. I like the back three. I think this is a positive start of the season for them to play that way, but there's still a very long way to go.
We are still seeing that incredible front three from them, but then still, so many do say that they're not going to give you anything defensively in a team like this.
And the challenge is always about PSG overcoming that hurdle. And both Jules and Frank are absolutely right. Given the discrepancy between PSG and everybody else in Ligue 1, the minimum you can expect is for them to win the league and quite comfortably. They barely have to be at 75% to do that. But to Pochettino's statement, you are then judged on performance in the Champions League. And given their spending, given the fact that you have three of arguably the top 10 strikers in the world as your front three, and on paper, both are more potent strike force than anybody else, You should be faring a whole lot better than you have been in the Champions League. And as Jules rightly points out, if you don't win it, you were supposed to make bigger and better clubs than you sweat. And too often, I think PSG have let themselves down in that regard. Last season, when they had Real Madrid, eventual champions Real Madrid, they had them right where they wanted them after the first leg. But it just feels, and this is a lot of my issue with PSG, it just seems as though arrogance comes back to cost them. And that is a bitter pill to swallow, when you're losing not because of your football, not because of your talent, but because of your arrogance. That will always be criticised.
And you probably remember, Frank, as well, the images where we saw that phenomenal front three up top and then the disconnect between them and the rest of the team in that game against Real Madrid. Can they still afford to do that this year?
Well, I guess they will, subconsciously, because that's the way they are made. You know, they're not there to defend, and they never did, and they will never do. They try to make an effort, but naturally they're going to go back to their weaknesses, which is not defending, not helping the team when they lose the ball. But I would say that it's almost the last season that we can see the arrogance that Xhaka is talking about, because they will have to face their responsibilities, and they will all do that, and I think they can work together very well. I think they have the coach for that, because he's a warrior and I know him very well, and I think Christophe Galtier is going to be ready to put some big star on the bench if they don't perform. That might be the big turn, and for them and their pride, again, I think it's the last season that they can pretend. Well, they cannot be the people that they normally are, and the people that we want to see them being, and they will have to show that. Otherwise, it's going to be the end of their era.
Jules, you mentioned Renato Sanchez. It's a deal that looks all but done. What does he bring to this team?
Yes, it's pretty much it's just done. I think it will be done in the next few hours. He brings versatility to start with, because he can play pretty much everywhere in that midfield, midfield four, midfield three, whatever system and formation you decide to play in. He's got that energy, of course. He's still young. He knows the manager and the sporting director very well from the time at Lille when they beat PSG to win the league as well. If he can stay fit, because this is the big problem here, of course, is his fitness. But if he stays fit and he's got the confidence and the momentum with him to be at his best, the best that we saw at Euro 2016, for example, the best that we saw at Benfica before things became more difficult in Germany and in England, and then even at times in France. But certainly the talent is there. It's I think he's someone that, even if he's on the bench, he's not going to go mad, and he's not going to, you know, kick the door and go crazy. He's a really good squad member, whether you start him or whether you bring him off the bench, for example. And I think you need players like that. You need also players like him who don't doubt, you know, who certainly have this ability when they're full of confidence to go in and be ready to take on anyone, because that's certainly the Renato Sanchez at his best that we know, that we saw before at a very young age. So I think for the amount they paid, which is just under the 15 million euro mark, because he only had 1 year left of his contract left at Lille, I think it's a bargain. It's a signing that you do every single day. There's not even a doubt. Again, especially with his relationship with Christophe Galtier and Luis Campos.
And meanwhile, Jules, the reports state that Paul Pogba has decided against surgery and will be looking for alternative treatment for his knee in the hope of making the World Cup this winter. What's the story here?
Well, I think personally, I think this is a fascinating story, because it's not the first time, and I think we're going to talk a lot about it more, but it was very much club against country. There was Juventus, who for them, it was much better if Paul was going into surgery, which means that I think the whole process had more certainties to it, but that means he would be only back in 2023. And then on the other side, for the national team and for Paul himself to go to the World Cup, he had to pick the other option, which was no surgery, another sort of rehabilitation, to put it simply, without the surgery, but then with the possibility of being back before the World Cup and being able to play in the World Cup. So very much club against country. Club pay the wages. I don't think Juventus are very happy that Paul decided to go against what they wanted, which was the surgery. And we will see in the end, things could go really well in the path that he chose, which is no surgery. The rehabilitation can work. He can go to the World Cup and then stay fit and then have a very good second half of the season with Juventus. But it might not also go that well. And what the surgery would have brought, which we're sure of it, was that the knee and the meniscus would be repaired and would be ready to go at the start of the new year. it's not so sure now with the other option that they chose. So fascinating story. Let's hope for everyone that everybody's happy at the end, because you don't want club to be angry with their players or with the national team because of some choices like that. So let's hope that everybody's happy in the end. Paul, France and the World Cup, and then Juventus as well when he comes back after the World Cup.
What do you think of it all, Frank? Would France still be able to win the World Cup without him?
Yes, of course. Nobody is indispensable, you know, in life, and is full of people completely indispensable in cemeteries, as we say in France. So, really, yeah, of course, France can win without Paul Pogba, but a very good Paul Pogba is very useful if he's fit. A Paul Pogba half fit is not useful, like nobody will be. It's a World Cup, you need to be in full strength, full physical capacities, and if he's not, he's going to take the place of somebody else. So it's going to be up to Didier Deschamps to consider if he has if he has to pick Paul Pogba or not according to his fitness. But it's a big gamble. Hopefully everything's going to go well for Juve, for France, and especially for Paul.
That's a tough decision, isn't it, Shaka, when you look at that? Because you can understand Paul Pogba's stance on this. He wants to go to the World Cup.
Absolutely. As a player, you fully sympathise. Give him everything that's at stake. Give him what the World Cup continues to mean to players, representing a country at that level. I totally sympathise. So you understand the decision. You similarly understand Juventus' own position in wanting their player. But ultimately, Paul Pogba has to do what he feels is right for him. And if he respects his role in the national team, if he respects what the World Cup means to him as a player, then do what's right for you. You know, you'll make it up in your performances to Juventus.
Oh, well, for more talk like this and plenty of debate too, you can catch more from Jules on the Gab and Jules podcast. That drops twice a week. And if you watch it online, you'll even get to see Gab's lovely knees.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Time to get you caught up on a little transfer news. Kasper Schmeichel heading to Nice. Must be nice. 1 million fee for him. Charles de Ketelaar for Milan. 29 million. Alex Telles is going to Sevilla on loan. And Oscar, remember him? Well, he's going to Flamengo. These are all according to reports, and you can stay up to date with all the latest transfer news over on our website. Be sure to check that out, especially because there is news coming in, it seems, every hour. But that will do it for the latest edition of the show. Be sure to stay with us because the boys will be back to answer your tweets on extra time. And Frank is in fine form. That's all I'll tell you. Make sure to stick around. Welcome into the latest edition of Extra Time. Kay Murray, Shaka Hislop, Julien Laron and Frank Leboeuf here with us. And it's not you just doing all the mixing and swooning and what? VIP hunting this week.
What are we talking about?
Well, it's usually you off to a party, oh, right, Shaka?
What are you talking about, Kay?
Getting honorary doctorates, getting given the freedom of cities.
Well, that aside, I don't know what you're talking about, Kay.
That's aside. This week, it's Jules.
Oh!
Who's been in the VIP sections.
Oh, he's just made for a red carpet, that boy.
On the red carpet, getting invited to premieres. A Prime Video, Amazon, Arsenal, all or nothing premiere. Can you give us any gossip, any inside info, Jules?
That's why he has Arsenal in his top three. He picked Arsenal first third, that's why.
Top four even. It was really good. It was great. It was great. Mikel Arteta was there, some of the players as well. And we had popcorn that was provided by Amazon Prime. And the documentary is good, you know. And I thought I put an effort with a sneaker. The suit, the shirt, the white t-shirt, you know, I thought I had to make an effort and look good. I didn't think that you would put it on the show, but, you know, I'm glad that I dressed properly.
Jules is easily pleased. Jules, we had popcorn.
No, truffle, yeah. Truffle and gold flakes on top of the popcorn. Great. Definitely. Yep.
All right.
Did they know who you were when you walked up, Jules, or did you have to give them your accreditation?
Yeah, I just see
fans over there. So, yeah. It is I, Julia Laram. All right.
Open the doors.
Hey, speaking of all these special names and everything, when will ESPN change Shaka Hislop's introduction in the graphics to Dr. Shaka Hislop?
I've been waiting on that for all my
Have
life.
Have you demanded it yet, Shaka?
Not yet. Not yet. You just watch this space. I refuse. I'm not using
you
that.
You're not going to use Doctor?
No.
What about when someone stays on a plane? Is there a doctor on the plane?
Like no, not at all.
You won't be taking it?
Yeah, no. Nope.
Chances of you using your honorary doctorate title as often as Frank mentions it in the World Cup.
If I get invited to a documentary at Arsenal, I'll use it.
All right.
That's the only
time.
I'll use that. And then if that fails, I'll say, I know Julien Laurent. I mean, popcorn and all.
Aye, aye, aye. To Shaka and Frank, was there any time just before the first game of the season that you knew you had a bad team and would struggle? Frank, I'll start with you.
No, because when you're a football player, you're quite optimistic, so you believe in miracle, I guess, and you want to think that everything is possible. But I never thought that way, you know, say, well, you know, we're not good, we're going to struggle this season. I played with Strasbourg, and even with the year after we were promoted, I never thought that I would be relegated again, and I really thought that everything was possible and that we will fight and we'll have a successful season, and it's what happened. No, I never thought I played in a bad team. I had the chance. I was fortunate to play with some good players alongside me.
Yeah, I agree. You never think that first game of the season. You never think. And oftentimes, even when you play with promoted teams, as I did in a couple of occasions, you come into the new league with such confidence from the previous season that it all comes down to how you start. So, for instance, I played with Portsmouth when Portsmouth was promoted into the Premier League. So that would have been 2003 season. Our first game was away to Manchester City. All right, this is before Manchester City were who they are today. But we went there and we were leading for most of the game, and then they scored very late on. But even then, you take such confidence from going to Manchester City and being, well, at least competing. They were the better team, I freely admit, but we got a point out of it. And you bring that confidence from the previous season with you. So you never find yourself starting a season that worried.
All right.
You know, it might be a hard season. You know, it'll be a long old season. But you have a certain level of confidence.
All right. For all, what's a popular food or dish that you hate? Jules. Not popcorn.
Ooh. Not popcorn. that I hate. I will go for Brussels sprouts. I'm not keen. And then
what?
In England, you put, you know, like the mint sauce and the all those weird sauce with your meat as well. I can't have that.
What's wrong with a bit of horseradish?
I love Brussels sprouts.
No, what? Not Brussels sprouts.
I'm not surprised posh. You do.
Crispy Brussels sprouts with a... Yeah, no.
I'm a little bit disappointed.
Right, I don't know if they're that popular, though, to be fair. No. Maybe more popular now. Frank?
You know, I just came back from Antigua and Barbuda, and they love to mix, you know, sweet and salted products. And it was a real issue for me, so I had to change all the menu at the hotel, so because I can't put pineapple, you know, with some meat, whatever it is, I need to separate everything. So I hate sweet and salted, and the worst for me is when you add cilantro. I hate cilantro.
That's genetic, I think, when
I smell that.
It's genetic.
Excuse me,
whether
that's
you
coriander.
Like it. It's
cilantro.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, whether you like it or
just genetic,
like it.
Whether you like it or not.
It's genetics. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I hate it. Really, it's not that I'm allergic to that, but I really hate it. I can throw up if you just put that in front of me. So I hate it. Leave me alone with that.
I actually have something in common with Frank that I don't like sweet and savory together very much.
I I have grown to not dislike it. Let me put it that way.
What is a popular food or dish that you hate?
You know what I don't like at all? Truffles.
Really?
I don't like truffles at all.
As in, we're talking not chocolate truffles, we're talking like truffle, yeah, like shavings.
Truffles. Right. I'm talking like real truffles.
Proper truffles, posh
proper truffles. Posh truffles.
They're so good.
No.
Yes, they are.
No, they're not.
No. Not for you.
I prefer to have pineapple on my pizza.
Oh, gosh, that's definitely saying something.
Trust me, I don't like pineapple on my pizza.
No.
I am not a fan of truffles at all.
Jules had it on his popcorn, I think.
Yeah, digestion problem?
Jules is Jules.
Let's
maybe
talk about Jules.
Digestion problem.
Jules.
Yeah.
Jules, on your podcast, Gab said no one wants to hear about your vacation and jumped into the content. Understandable. But I thought that was rude and I'm interested in your summer holiday. So are we.
Thank you.
Well, look, by the way, Gab tells everybody about his holidays, by the way. Gab tells everybody, wears his shorts and his flip-flops on his show, tells everybody about his holidays because of Jules Short.
Yeah, Jules, so tell us, this is your platform.
Yeah, go on, Jules.
Yeah, and he was grumpy already because there was some change in the studio with the sound and everything, so he was not happy to start with. We had a lovely holiday. We went to France in Ile de Ré, a small island of La Rochelle, with the family. It was great. We had an amazing weather and the beach and the swimming pool. Great foods. I recommend some really, really lovely restaurant there, La Cible and Taxi Brousse. So if you're looking for a little bit of paradise, go to Ile de Ré.
I'm on my way.
Nice healthy glow there as well, Jules. Another one for Jules. Who would be your dream guest on your podcast with Marcotti? One player, one coach, and one executive or commentator?
Ooh.
Jules, that's a good question.
Me.
He won the World Cup. You know, Frank won the World Cup.
In case you didn't know.
Just in case.
I think it's hard to not pick someone like Pelé, for example, who I think would be, you know, if he's in good health and can have a few hours to talk about his life and his incredible career, then I think you take it. You take Zinedine Zidane. Of course, you know, you take players like that who can, I think, inspire people, who have loads of stories to tell, who've obviously have been great players or great men. I think spending time with Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp as well on a show when they have time to speak about their philosophies and their methodologies and all their success would be amazing as well. I would love 3 hours with Pep Guardiola when he's really committed to talking about himself and the work that he does. And same with Jurgen Klopp, for example, and a few others. So the list would be very long. If I had to pick just one, I think you'd have to look at someone like Pelé or you know, even Messi or Cristiano. I think having quality time with those guys would be something very, very special, I think.
I don't understand
because, you know, I don't know if you see that, because I've got a picture with Pelé here, you know. Zidane played with me. Yeah, I have so many stories to tell you, so why don't you pick me? I don't get it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Hang on, would you tell those stories though on the record?
On the red card? Of no.
Record.
would you tell those stories knowing it's going out to the public?
I can tell you all stories, you know. I don't know. The thing is that, you know, what can I say? You know, at the beginning, the morning of the World Cup, you know what I ate with Zinedine Zidane? We were only the two of us at the breakfast. You know what we ate to be in a good shape for the World Cup?
What?
Okay. Crepes. We had crepes with Nutella.
Crepes and Nutella. Any banana
in
there?
And we won the World Cup.
Whatever
maybe,
you do, Jules,
maybe.
Don't get Frank. Nobody wants to hear about Frank's crepes.
I mean,
do not get Frank.
That would have been a headline for your podcast,
exactly.
Wouldn't it? Frank had a crepe.
I had a crepe. All the press world. You just wait for this world. Frank had a crepe.
And so did Caesar.
Only two of them. Only two crepes. Yeah, two crepes.
And that's the reason they won the World Cup.
Yeah, that is the worst podcast in history.
Jules, while you are here... Jules, while you are here, what's going on with Gab getting his legs out on the podcast? Gab, yeah. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, no, but you know what? Actually, we were lucky this year because usually he puts his shorts on the first day of spring. It's automatic in his head. First day of spring, whenever that is, March 20 something or something like that. He puts the shorts out and then I see his legs all the time with his trainers, all of that. This year, somehow, I'm not even sure why, maybe the weather was not great when it was the start of spring, but he delayed a lot putting the shorts. He has those trousers who are too short, by the way. He wore them longer than usual. So, you know, we were lucky this year.
Do you ever borrow Gab's clothes?
I just want to know something on that picture. It's very strange because the knee and the thigh seems to be very big. But you can you tell me where the calves are? Because it seems to me that he lost the calves.
I think it's the angle. Frank, how would you feel if he came to a restaurant dressed like this?
No chance.
I would be so disappointed. As an Italian guy, you know, that would be over. Oh, my
goodness
God. No crepes, no pizza with pineapple for him, and no coriander, for sure.
No coriander, okay. Start bench or sell. David Villa, Diego Forlan, Fernando Torres, all in their prime.
Ooh. David Villa, Diego Forlan, Fernando Torres. Goodness me. Start Torres, bench Villa, sell Forlan.
Okay. Jules?
Yeah, I think I'm going to say Shaka. I think the Torres of Liverpool was just... was the best. It was the best in Europe. He was unplayable. I think Villa... At Barcelona, certainly in a team that was really good already with Messi, showed everything he could do for a team like that. And then Forlan was a great striker, great finisher, but not on the level of the other two. So I go like Xhaka.
All right, I've got actually. Do you want to weigh in on that, Frank?
No, I'm good with the guys. You know, I have not much to say about those three players. You know, but I'm good with the guys.
So we've got a little spirit of this competition at this start bench cell. We're going to do a Chelsea one here, splashing the cash. Jules, we wanted to put this one out there. So we're seeing Sesko, who they've been linked with, a striker from Salzburg. Aubameyang in the mix there now. Frankie de Jong, said to have made an approach to Barcelona for him. Wesley Fofana and Denzel Dumfries. Is there anyone that you'd like to pick out here? Which is the one that you're most interested in?
So for me, I mean, it's quite, it's pretty simple and obvious. I think De Jong and Fofana are the two really out of this world on a very good bunch of the players that you name. If you get Fofana, who he's still so young, has incredible talent and potential, can be at Chelsea for the next 10 years and be an incredible player, you go and you spend the money for him. If you can get Frankie de Jong, who again, even if you feel maybe now you don't need another midfielder because you already have a lot, he's a game changer for me. If you get the de Jong that we saw at Ajax at his best. So for me, if you could pick two out of the five that you name or six that you name, Cesco is a very talented young player, very promising, but he's not ready yet to make an impact in a team like that. And when I mean impact, you walk in the team and then you change the team. I think de Jong and Fofana can do that more as well than Aubameyang or what's the other one that you said? I don't know who it was, but yeah, for me, Fofana and de Jong are the two outstanding ones.
It's interesting though, isn't it, Jules? Because the report is when it comes to the de Jong chat and the fact that Chelsea is said to have made an approach to Barcelona for him, that he would be more open for a move to Stamford Bridge than to Old Trafford. Is that what you're hearing too?
I mean, he wants to play Champions League football, which I don't think you can blame him for. So United not having Champions League, which is a problem for Cristiano as well, is a problem for De Jong too. And I think for others as well. Chelsea offer you the Champions League, offer you a team that is... You know, that has won the Champions League not long ago, for example, with a manager that has won it too. So
I still believe that De Jong wants to stay at Barcelona, who's still owing money. We're not going to go back again on what we talked about it before when he was linked with United. But this is a very complicated deal. I don't know who is manufacturing the contact, if it's Barcelona or if it's Chelsea. But I think Chelsea have other positions to strengthen before midfield anyway. But if you can get De Jong at some point, if you've got the money, then again, I think he's a game changer.
Frank, tell us one good story about George Weah that you can only share with us. Why don't people rate him with the greats when he's the only African to have ever won the Ballon d'Or?
I played many times against him when he was in Monaco and after in Paris Saint-Germain, and I had the big chance to play 6 months with him at Chelsea when we won the FA Cup final in 2000. The guy was at the end of his career. He couldn't play the full game, but every time he went on, he was a game changer and a fantastic teammate. I remember playing against George Weah in Paris Saint-Germain, and he fell in front of me, pretending that I touched him, and I got a penalty against me. And I said to the ref, I said, do you really think, because I was playing for Strasbourg, Paris Saint-Germain needs that to win a game against the poor Strasbourg? And the player of Paris Saint-Germain got very upset with me saying that. And George Weah came to me and laughed at it. And he said, you know, I'm very sorry. I felt like a jerk, but I guess we needed that today. He was such a gentleman. I love this guy. I'm so pleased that he's the head of his country, because he's really somebody special, and I really love him.
You know what? If it makes the tweeter feel better, I feel that so many people in the know do rate George Weah really highly.
Absolutely, without question. I mean, certainly if we're talking African players, you cannot talk about African football without mentioning George Weah in the very first sentence. If the discussion here is he's not discussed in the same sentences with Pelé, Maradona, Ronaldo, Messi, Portuguese, well, understandably, I think they just have better records. But if we are talking about the greats, any longer a list of all-time greats of world football, George Weah absolutely is in discussion.
Question for Jules. Do you think Koundé will have...
I'm sorry, Kay. Remember, you know, everybody remember Maradona getting the ball and scoring against England, and then everybody remember Messi doing the same. Remember that George Weah, playing for AC Milan, took the ball in his own 16-yard box and took on every player to go to score at San Siro. The guy was able to do what everybody did. I don't know, because he was from Liberia, maybe people forgot about him, but we are talking about one of the greatest footballer ever. And it's sad in a way that he was born in Liberia, football-wise, because he couldn't have a chance to win a World Cup. But I would have paid a lot, because we are talking about transfer fees. I would have paid millions of pounds for George Weah, for sure.
He wouldn't get upset about millions and millions
like
and millions.
4 million for
would have
George
paid 2.5 earlier on the show. Just for context, earlier on in the show today, Frank got very upset about some of the hefty transfer fees
Cucurella
for certain players.
For 50 million.
Yes.
I can't believe it.
He mentioned a Tafe a lot in that. All right. Question for Jules. Do you think Koundé will have some pressure on him this season on a bigger stage at Barcelona? World Cup around the corner. And how do you think he will improve his game at Barca under Xavi?
It's a good question. I think there's a lot of pressure on him, for sure. This is a very important season, but especially the start of it, to make the World Cup squad, which I think he will. But also to show to everyone that he's at that level, that he can play there. I've got a few reservations in the sense that Barcelona seems to be going for Inigo Martinez as well, Athletic Bilbao, which surprises me a little bit, because that maybe would mean that Xavi sees Koundé and maybe even Araujo as a more of a right back maybe than a centre back, which Koundé can play there. He did it with the national team at the Euros, not that that went well, but he can play there. I don't think this is his best position. Unless you play with a hybrid sort of back four, back three, where he's a centre back that plays a right back, but when you're in possession of the ball, it becomes a back three, and then it's your left back, Jordi Alba, who is the most attacking one, which, again, that works for me. But it's big. He went there for Xavi, he said that himself. And I think he expects to improve a lot, to progress a lot with the coaching of Xavi, which again, I'm all for it, but now he will have to show us and to prove it. I think Bordeaux was good for him. He made the right step up with Sevilla, great, and he had some great years. Last season was a bit more difficult. And now again, this is the step up. And now we see if he's good enough for that level.
What do you think, Frank?
I agree with Jules. I think he's a very good player, and I think it's a good signing because it's a good choice from Koundé, who knows La Liga, and he's reaching another level of pressure in terms of expectation. But I think it's a good choice for him, and it's time for him to go to that level and we'll be willing to reach the top of the top, and being sure that to go to the World Cup, it's a good choice. So I'm confident that he's going to be successful because he's a very good player.
All right, well, we'll put it to an end there. Frank has got to go and polish his World Cup. Jules has got to go and check all his emails for all those for all those invites.
I'm going to the premiere to go to tonight.
Yeah,
you know,
red carpet events, Neymar's birthdays, all these things. And
You know what, Kay? You know, it's funny that Jules told us that if De Jong will be a very good signing, Chelsea will be a very good choice for De Jong because they can do well. Well, Jules put Chelsea behind Manchester United, where De Jong might be signing. So De Jong is signing for a worse club than Manchester United because it's better for him. Whatever, I don't get that.
Because of Champions League, you clearly didn't listen. Because of the Champions League. But you know what, if Chelsea signed De Jong, I put them fifth, just for you.
Frank came on the show ready to fight.
Okay, good.
We should just leave these locked in the studio room on their own.
Frank chose violence today.
The guy is invited. No, but the guy is invited at us for Arsenal, and he puts up them before Arsenal.
Give Frank, we'll be back tomorrow. Frank will still be talking.
Give Frank some coriander. Let's call it a night.